Maybe let's get started. I know we do have a number of people online, so I'd like to welcome everybody to the NEET-WO seminar. Today we have Professor Peter Pongers, who's both from Unilever and professor at Eindhoven Technical University. And just to give you a little bit of background about him, he's actually a mechanical engineer by training, obtained his master's degree at Delft in 86, and then later on his PhD, actually in the area of systems and control, also at Delft. He joined Unilever in 1994 and has been working in areas such as modeling and control, supply chain, and he's currently the director of structured materials and process science platform. In 2008, he became professor at the Eindhoven University of Technology, and he holds there the chair for product-driven process engineering. And he's actually an author of a number of papers that have to do with planning, scheduling in the food industry, use of supercritical CO2 for drying, determining crop sizes for emulsions, their distribution, and so forth. And, of course, also a number of papers in the area of process control. He's also written a very nice monograph on product and process design. Professor Peter Pongers has also been very active professionally. He's the representative of the Netherlands at the Working Party of the European Federation of Chemical Engineering in the group of computer-aided process engineering. And because of that, of course, you know, he's been also active participating and giving presentations at the ESCAPE meetings. So the idea today is that he's going to talk to us about factory operations, modeling, scheduling, and implementation. He's going to describe an industrial case study. And one of the interesting aspects, I think, of the talk will be also the issue of use of some commercial software in order to address some of these problems. Okay? So, again, Peter, you're welcome, and we look forward to your talk. All right? By the way, before we start, just like in the past, we would like to ask people to mute their phones. I think it's usually #6 the way you do that. So just make sure that we don't have sort of background noise. All right? So, again, Peter, it's all yours.
Thank you very much, Ignacio. First of all, thank you for the invitation and for the very nice words that you you spoke, but I will not say dwell on those. So what you see, the first slide is the title of my talk. It's the Factory Operations, Modeling, Scheduling, and the Implementation. And I want to demonstrate that on an industrial case. Basically, as I'm part of Unilever as a company, first start with Unilever at a glance. You may not know Unilever, but I know for sure that you all know our products and our brands. And most likely you've even used one of those of our products during this day, if not in the shower to wash your hair or to eat eat a snack, maybe to eat an ice cream, drink a tea, or whatever. So basically, Unilever is a food and home and personal care company, and our mission is to add vitality to life. So we meet everyday needs for nutrition, hygiene, and personal care with brands that help people feel good, look good, and get more out of life. So basically, Unilever has about 150 million times a day. In over 150 countries, people are using our key products at key moments of their day. But there's 150 million opportunities to make a positive difference to people's lives. The other side of the coin is there's also 150 million opportunities to get things wrong. And then basically, you destroy your brand. So we have to have it at least 150 million times a day, get it, our products right, and satisfy what the consumer wants to get out of our products. If you look to the Unilever Research and Development Organization, basically there are about 6,000 people employed in research and development in Unilever. We have six global, what we call discover and design, but are the typical research sites, and you see the yellow dots, and they're heavily European focused. There is one in the States, that's in Trimble in New York, one in Shanghai, one in Bangalore, India, and then there's one in Port Sunlight in the UK, one in Cork in the UK, and one in Vlaardingen in the Netherlands, and that's basically the location where I'm based. And then, having discovered new products, new benefits, we are then going to design the portfolio and going to deploy it in our in the different countries. And the design deploy sites you see in the red circles, and they're more scattered around the globe. So, what is it that I want to talk to you about? Basically, I want to start on the motivation. I want to look into some practical processes and challenging. Then I want to look into scheduling model design, so what we call factory structure, material flows, constraint changeovers, multi-stage scheduling model, how we come to implement it and how we have implemented it in commercial software, and why commercial software is so important to us as a company. And I will end with results and some concluding remarks. And then after that, I would like to invite you to ask a lot of questions. So start with the motivation. The operation schedule is you need to produce the products when they're needed. So for example, if you want to make a lot of ice creams that you want to buy in the summer, they make everything in January, and hope that the weather is so good that we can sell exactly everything in August. The weather is too bad, probably we're left with half of the stocks. If the weather is too good, we're out of stock, probably as the first week of August. So, producing when it is needed. We also have to be very flexible. So, flexibility in production. If we don't sell one of our products, but we do sell another one, much better, because either there's a lot of marketing around it or there's an hype in consumers. We need to switch our production quite rapidly. So flexibility in production is extremely important. The other thing is you need to choose when and where to produce. So not to do everything every time, every day. Basically, we found a nice quote in this article that, in spite of the fact that during the last decade, many companies have made large investments in development as well as implementation of scheduling systems, not that many systems appear to be used on a regular basis. Systems after being implemented often remain in use for only a limited amount of time, and after a while, they often are, for one reason or another, ignored altogether. This is something that, from even in if you're working in a company in an R&D function, if you want to implement things in a factory, acceptability of the factory is key. It is relatively easy to stand with 5 PhDs with a white coat around an equipment and run it for 5 minutes, but if it runs in a factory, it needs to run 24 hours a day, and if you talk about equipment, also need to run with people who hardly can read or write. Same holds for if you look to any control system, any scheduling system, if it doesn't reflect what the scheduler or the operator thinks intuitively about his or her factory or plant, in the end they will not believe it. They will find a way that our situation where the model or the systems are wrong, and they will switch it off. And very often, if you then go back into a factory, you might see very nice computers that need to be bought for this particular application, standing in a corner of a room collecting dust. And that is not what we want. So, looking into the gap between theory and practice, and look into a number of things. For example, the complexity. So, basically, in the real world, all the aspects, the constraints, the rules, the assumptions that are relevant for the scheduling problems and the relationship between those, they need to be incorporated in any model of the factory that you want to use to schedule the factory. You need to avoid any nervousness in the scheduling in situations with uncertainty. So, for example, if sometimes one of the packing lines is running at a higher speed than predicted, then basically it's consuming more materials, so the tanks are emptying earlier. And if you then want to reschedule that every half minute, then basically we're introducing a lot of uncertainty and a lot of, let's say, nervousness in the plant that we don't need to have. Because one of the things that any operational scheduling system should bring to a factory is a kind of a steadiness, a predictability. We need to look into the organizational embedding, so the alignment of the scheduling decisions within the business. The availability and accuracy of data. If this condition is not met, then the scheduling model will be incorrect. For example, if you think that the line is running with a certain speed, and it's running with a different speed, and basically the timings on which you have to make mixes and pack them, etc., they're not being met. And then basically the model, the scheduling model, is not predicting what is happening in the factory, and people will not believe it anymore. So one of the things that we found every time and time again that we went into a factory, if you ask the line speed into three different departments of the factory, you get three different answers. Even if you ask it to the operators, and you ask it from the day, the night, and the evening shift, you get three different answers on the line speeds. And that is something that I cannot stress well enough, is that the accuracy of the data is paramount in order to get the things really synchronized with the models and the factory floor. And the interaction with the human scheduler, and then it's recognized, let's say, that the human scheduler will remain an indispensable factor in the scheduling process. However, many techniques do not account for interaction with the human scheduler. If you look to a reasonable complex plant, as you saw that we in Unilever, we make a lot of different products. If you have 5-10 different packing lines, sometimes even more, a lot of different process lines, and you will immediately imagine that there is a lot of connection between the different process lines and the different packing lines. From a flexibility point of view, the operators want to be as flexible as possible, so they would like to be connected, every process to be connected to every packing line. From a logistics and a management point of view, you would like to have as little connections as possible, because every flexibility that you have, definitely in a food factory, you need to clean the lines. And if you haven't cleaned the line, you have a big risk of contamination, and then you might have to have a recall of your product, and that is disastrous. So knowing that the lines are clean when you're using them, etc., that type of hygiene manufacturing is much more sure if you have less connections than if you have more connections. So there's always a trade-off between what the operators would like to have, which is maximum flexibility, and basically what you should offer in any scheduling model, which is a restricted flexibility. The other thing that we noticed in there is that, for example, an operator might want to have a certain connection between a process and a packing line for a product that they're going to make once in a year. In order to incorporate those, let's say, exceptions in a model, that might be enormously elaborate. So one of the things that we've said is that, okay, if that's the case, if you only want to run it once in a year in that configuration, it's an exception. Treat it as an exception. We will not put it in any of those models. So that is the trade-off in the, let's say, the complexity in the real world and the complexity that we need to have in the scheduling models. That the scheduling model should be compact, small enough, small enough to be manipulated, but they should be rich enough to describe the factory. Because if they do not describe the factory, they will not be used once we have the best one. Okay. Now let's go to the an ice cream case study.
No, I'm with you. There's nothing on 14 to call that useful.
This is a list of the complexity of one of the ice cream factories. 12 pick lines. There's a limited availability of staff. There's constraint on auxiliary equipment, so fruit feeders, secondary packagers. Buffer tanks per line vary in number and size. Packing lines are sharing buffers. Two process lines to feed all the packing lines, and they have different capabilities. There are about 136 SKUs, and the SKUs can be produced at multiple lines. There are about 150 recipes. So we also fresh dairy ingredients, which have a limited shelf life. There's in-house cone production, as well as cones that are being bought in for the production. There's stringent cleaning regimes in the process in cases of allergens. The minimum and maximum standing times in the buffers. And there's a mandatory cleaning in place, 24-hour cycle on the process, and a 72-hour cycle on all the other equipment. So this is the situation in one of the factories. And the first question to ask is, do we need any scheduling tool? Do we need any scheduling model in order to run this factory? Basically, this slide will to show a kind of a trade-off where, in our view, we should go to a modeling of the factory and a kind of a multi-stage scheduling approach, and where we can still use our, say, engineering rules of thumb to run the factory. So if we go from left to right, if you see, if we have very low utilization of the lines, okay, there's sufficient time on the lines to, let's say, to accommodate the production. So if you have a high utilization, so more than 70% of the time the lines are being used, then that's not something you can do by hand anymore. If you have a lot of multi-stage production, so the production is not in one stage, but there are multiple stages to make a final product, and there are a number of shared resources in the production. If you have a complex product mix, so a lot of different products compared to a single product. If you have a short production run, so a lot of changeovers compared to very low production runs, then you don't need any, let's say, may not need any modeling tools. If you want to de-automate the existing site or rationalize many plants into one, if you want to have controlled inventory, storage, and delivery, those are the, let's say, the aspects that are going for a multi-stage scheduling approach. Basically, as a company, we want to be in that area, because that area is minimizing our capital, because we're using our assets to high utilization, and we have an increased flexibility in short runs, etc. So, if you look to a lot of the factories, factory managers and engineering managers, they would rather be on the top side of this graph, because then they can invest in steel, in new equipment. That's basically their business. From a business point of view, you would like to be in the bottom part. So that is where you can get most out of in our case, maybe the euros or the dollars that we're investing in our equipment. Yeah? But this is a kind of a decision sheet where you can say, okay, there's far more ticks in the blue box. That means that you cannot run your factory efficiently without any scheduling system. So we make an overview of a number of commercial software for scheduling. And basically there are two types of software. One of them is it's part of an integrated ERP system like SAP, like GDA Edwards, and basically you get the scheduling tool that company has. And then there are some other scheduling softwares, for example like the Infor, which you might say is kind of a best-in-class or better-in-class software, but it might not be really compatible with the ERP systems that are running in a lot of the factories. So this is one of the other added complexity, is that a lot of the companies are running software like SAP for the ERP system, for the MRP system, for the financial system, and basically they would like to implement the scheduling software, but as long as it is part of their existing software suite. And that software, the scheduling tools of the software suite might not be suitable to solve the problems in that industry. So that is something that needs to be investigated. So one of the things that we said, okay, what are the necessary conditions to enable a successful implementation? And I've listed a couple over here. Is basically the model of the plan need to be sufficient accurate representation of the real situation. The graphical user interface for the plan scheduler needs to be intuitive and represent the plans. The software should be usable by the plan scheduler, who in general does not have an academic grade. And this is another very important aspect. So we might have to tune down our solutions. The solution or the schedule need to be robust rather than optimal to the last decimal digit. So one important item to robustness is that the same schedule is generated even if there are small changes in the input. And also I want to stress this point, especially to our academic partners, is that very often we are very focused on, let's say, the optimal solutions and having the minimum calculated, whereas in industry we are mainly interested in a robust solution. So we rather say, okay, even if we're 70% right, but 70% right is so much better than we have now, but if it's robust, we go for it. The schedule of the complete plans need to be generated in a relatively short period of time. We have internally a kind of rule of thumb of the one cup of coffee. So if we go to the coffee machine, if we, say, solve this problem, we go to the coffee machine, have a coffee, and come back, which takes about 50 minutes, then basically you want to have the solution there in order to deal with decisions that you have to make on the factory floor. Because you cannot wait, let the people in production wait for about 24 hours in order to say, okay, now I figured out what you could have done 23 hours ago. So the software needs to be able to deal with breakdown of equipment and best professors that are partly failed still, and communication with other factory software such as master data. Such that master data is only stored in one location to prevent errors. So this is very important. But the master data contains information such as specific capabilities, capacities, bills of materials, routings, alternatives, etc. Yeah. So if you look to what demands or what requirements we set on the scheduling software, I haven't mentioned anything about, let's say, the details of how we're calculating the solutions or whatever software package or whatever. These are the things that are extremely important in order to make sure that the software or the models that we're going to implement are being accepted by the business. And one thing that I cannot, let's say, stress enough is that the consistency of the data and that if you talk to the managers of the factory, they might have a completely different picture about how the factory is run than the operators who are really running the factory. Yeah. And that a lot of data that has been put into all these ERP systems are put in there for financial reasons, and to make the financial calculations, and not necessarily the operational or the planning or the scheduling decisions. So, for example, if you want to, if you reduce the speed of your line in a financial calculation, that means that per hour you're producing less product, so it will cost more of the product. But if that lower speed, if you're going to use it in a scheduling situation, basically your tanks might be empty in half the time. Your lines are standing idle. So, implementing also this type of software might mean that the master data need to be adapted, and that might mean that the whole financial picture of the factory might be changed. And some of the SKUs where initially they thought they were making a huge profit on, they might not make a profit anymore, and other ones they might have a big profit on. So if you look to Unilever, we have SAP implemented as an MRP system. So the things that we've been looking to, if you look to scheduling, can we do this with SAP? With SAP is PPDS, spreadsheet planning, detailed scheduling. So overall, there's only, say, SAP is leading in Unilever, and there's only one plan. And of course, we should not have two different plans in one factory. So there's only one plan, and that's the plan that has been, say, confirmed in SAP. However, everything that is critical within 24 hours has to be handled out there outside SAP. So materials requirements in SAP are generated for complete run or 24 hours, whichever one is the shortest. Some processes are not suitable for PPDS. So buffer vessels or intermediate vessels, shared resources. And as a food business, we have an enormous amount of those. Multiple tech manufacturing levels are not implemented there. And everything that is not operational has to be handled outside SAP, so scenarios and change of plans. So, but in general, if you look to it, this is a picture of scheduling complexity. And the big complexity that we found in any scheduling model are either buffer vessels and shared resources. If you look to, I put some levels there, 1, 2, 3, it is the level upstream of the packing line. And the further upstream you have a shared resource, further upstream you have a buffer vessel, the more complex is the scheduling problem. And in the food industry, we have quite a lot of buffer vessels. We have quite a number of shared resources at different levels. So basically, the scheduling problems that we are facing with in the food industry are quite complex. So what we've done is we've constructed a reduced complexity model to evaluate commercial scheduling software. And this is a process flow diagram of that reduced complexity model. It's one process feeding two sets of buffer vessels, feeding each of those buffer vessels, set of buffer vessels is feeding a packing line. Information on the SKUs on the mix, minimum standing time, maximum standard time in the buffer vessels. On the mix is what SKU, what mix is in there, what is the packing rate, and what's the packing line, and there's collection demand, and there's changeover information, both on the mixing as well as on the packing information. And we've asked a number of software companies Faraday could solve this this problem. We knew by hand we could do this in about 120 hours production on the packing lines. And safer was what we have found, but only M4 commercial scheduling package was able to produce a feasible schedule. And you see the schedule on the screen, where on the bottom two bars are the packing lines, one and two for the different SKUs. You've got six vessels, and you've got a process line. So, although say, a number of companies have tried to solve, or commercial software companies have tried to solve this problem, we haven't found, apart from Info, any suitable commercial supplier yet. So basically, that led us to the fact that if you want to solve these type of scheduling problems for our company, we found that SAP was not able to do it. We needed to go to another software company, and we found that Info was the only company who could do this. Why are we going to an external software company? Because as a R&D organization, we are never able to support up to 30, 40 factories in implementing this type of software systems. For example, if now one of the operating software's operating systems is changing a little bit, you might have to rewrite, let's say, all the code. And basically, as an R&D organization, we are absolutely not suited for that. So that is why we need an external company, and preferably an external company who knows a bit about scheduling. So we now have an external company or an external software selected. We can now look into, okay, what will happen if we now come to implement this in that complex factory that I've showed before. So we have several packing lines, two process lines, local processes, etc. And basically, this is the kind of flow sheet that we have been working on. First of all, you see at the top left, you see a green box where there's a factory structure. And basically, out of the process flow diagrams of the factory, the interviews with operators, maintenance, standard operating procedures, we are deriving what we call factory structure. And that is something like this. Well, for example, you see two process lines. Some of the process lines some vessels are connected to both process lines, and some vessels are connected to only a limited set of process lines. See different, all these vessels, there are freezers attached to it, and then there are packing lines. For example, what you see over here is that these two vessels connected to this freezer, they can go to, for example, the Roller 3, which is a rotating freezer line roller product. This vessel can feed it, this vessel can feed it, and this vessel can feed it. So you see over here, on the bottom row, there is a lot of stability on freezers connected to aging vessels, aging or better tanks that can feed into all these different packing machines. After those packing machines, there are even, let's say, the iron thermal tabling machines, fruit feeders, secondary packing machines, and we don't have sufficient of those to put them behind every packing line. So we only put them behind the lines that need them for a specific product. So that's flexible material, and that is a shared resource, and that is a constraint. basically, he's been using systems theory and modeling, process engineering, in order to get to what we think is the factory structure. Because also, if you want to be accurate in, let's say, 15-minute intervals, there's no use of describing, let's say, every pump that has a that is switching on and off within a couple of seconds. So this is where we make the decision, what do we include in the model and what do we not include in the model. Then we have the routing files in the factory, so which products are being made on which lines, bit of materials, and again the process flow diagrams and the standard operating procedures, and we create a material flow structure. And that's, for example, looking like this. We start with some purchasing orders. We have ingredients on inventory, and they go to, for example, the cone bakers, the cone inventory, and we have cones that we can then, for example, sell to another factory, or we can use the cones to make our own products. Flavor vessels, sauce vessels, aging vessels, with pieces, we mix it. So this is where we make the standard in ice cream. But there are a lot of other type of operations in this factory. For example, that we make our own chocolate. And there are some ice creams that are being hot filled, but they're not being cooled down before they're filled. So they have special vessels, the jelly, what we call the jelly vessels. So this is the material flow diagram of this factory.
Just a small interruption, sorry. It looks like somebody has not muted their telephone. We hear some conversation in the background, kind of low. Can you hear that? Well, I don't know where it's coming from, but in any way. So, Peter, let's continue. So that's fine. Thank you.
Okay. Basically, those two things together with the constraints, and constraints are an exchange over structure. And here you see what the changeover information is that we've been using. So the pasteurizer, the process, it's color and allergens. And you see over here the changeover matrix for the colors. There's a similar one for the allergens. And basically we're looking, for example, if you have a green mix without any allergen and we go to a red mix with a lot of allergens, we have a longer cleaning time that we need. On the packing lines, you also see if you have certain products, for each product, type of product, you might need a different nozzle, and changing the nozzles will take you quite some time. So all this has been built in our, what we call our sourcing unit model, and that is still a kind of a paper model, and that's also what we or a kind of a out of this paper model, we make specifications over here for the data out of the changeover data, the routing, and the bill of materials, and that information that should be standard available in the factory. And we have a kind of a data market and a specification as kind of a meta model. That we write a kind of a meta model that we can then directly read into the software implementation. Yeah. Although it sounds a little bit critical, it is a little bit critical, very often all these software packages, they cannot deal with let's say large amounts of data at one time. So if you have a product, you have to specify per product on what kind of equipment it will be run. And you have to do that for all products. And that is a kind of a mechanism that we have automated, so we go one level higher, that we, based on our social unit model, we know what we want to get into the simulation model, and we get all that data that we need out of the basically operating data and the systems in the factory, like the bill of materials, the working files, etc. Then we can have a look back and go to the inputs, because we, if we need to have a schedule, we need to have kind of a production plan, we need to know the initial inventory, we need to know the purchase orders, and we can bring everything together, and out of that we can make the production schedule, the intermediate schedules, and the ingredient collapse schedule. It looks then something like this. And what you see on the bottom is the other production lines. You see the production order or batch, the continuous line over there. Changeover are the right boxes. And you see that the right boxes, they vary from size depending on what product you're switching over to what other product. And you see in the colors, you see white, gray, blue are shift patterns. And the yellow part is the non-working time. Above it, you see the aging tanks. The first part is the filling. Then the deep color part is aging, or the minimum, between the minimum standing time in the vessels. White parts are waiting. And the dashed part, or the dotted part, is the emptying of those vessels. Top, you see the pasteurizer and the premixers. So what's the conclusion? Is that the implementation of operational multi-stage scheduling leads to feasible routes to reduce cost per ton manufactured products by raw material waste reduction, which I haven't shown, but basically, because we now know when to start at the line, and we can only start at the line if we know that there's sufficient raw material to produce a complete batch, we don't need to stop in between. And because we don't need to stop, we don't have any waste in between. But the other thing what we notice is that we have increased the available capacity of the factory by about 30%. So basically, we were able to squeeze about 30% more products out of the factory without any mechanical changes. And I think that is probably far more important than maybe even the increased capacity, is that the factory is in control of their make operation. Yeah? So it is not chasing your own tail. It's basically quite a steady production if you have a planning window of a week. The plan is hardly changing anymore. Everybody knows what they have to do in order to make the right output. So, some barriers and still challenges. In general, the problems occur at the interfaces. It's easy said, but I think it's still true that most of the problems occur between the departments and not inside one specific department. And I cannot stress is that factory data is not reliable, inconsistent, or not consistent. And it holds for specifications, flow diagrams, line speed, shift variations, whatever. For operational implementation, I think that you need kind of a BSC level for running the system. If you don't have that in the factory, then you probably should not even start with it. And there's a cultural change needed inside the factory, is that in the food industry, the packing lines are the lines that are visible for the management team. So if the packing lines are standing idle, then something must be wrong. So packing lines should always run. Well, that's not the case. the bottleneck should always be run and should be fully utilized. So that means that the pipeline operators are no longer in charge of running the factory. It is the scheduler who is in charge, and the scheduler will maximize the output of the total factory, not of one pipeline. And master data maintenance is key, because if a factory gets a new set of products and the maintenance of master data is not well anchored inside the factory, then basically you will run into problems where you have products that you don't have the bill of materials, if you don't have the routings, and the products need to be produced now. So it's outside the system, and if it happens too often, people don't use the systems anymore. So with these two things, I would like to thank you for your attention, and I will be happy to answer almost all questions, if I can.
Okay, all right, thank you very much. Let's see, I don't know if there is anybody out there who would like to ask a question to Dr. Peter Bongers. Usually we have a shy audience. let me perhaps just to start to kick off the questions. One of the things I'm very curious, you mentioned you tried different software packages and you ended up with Infor. Do you know anything about what's behind that package, in the sense, what type of scheduling model is it using? Is it doing, I don't know, STN, RTN? Is it doing some type of, special multi-stage type of algorithm? Any insight on what they're doing? Because, of course, I mean, if they're the only ones who are able to solve your problem, it must hopefully mean that they have some good technique behind them. Do they disclose?
Yeah, I think the key thing is, I don't know exactly what they're doing.
Okay.
I do know that for some of the optimizers, they use the iLOC algorithms.
Okay, so that's iLOC, that's probably CPLEX. So it must be at least mixed integer. That's one hint. So.
Yeah.
Sorry, take it back. I mean, there is some software from iLOC which is not necessarily optimization related. So,
that's also one of the things. This is kind of an allocation software, allocation tools, and that is very very powerful. What we found.
I see.
One of the things that is, especially if you go to very high utilization, is that the real solution space is getting so narrow and so difficult to find that a lot of our unknown mixed integer solvers are taking too long to find anything.
Yeah. Well, that could actually imply, I don't know, just a wild guess, constraint programming. Constraint programming actually works very nicely when you have highly constrained problems. And so I do know iLOC also has some products along those lines. So I don't know. Bruno?
Hi, Peter. This is Bruno Ignacio, student. I have a curiosity about your presentation. In the beginning, you said that scheduling models should be solved quickly and within 15 minutes or so. So how long is the time horizon that you are considering that case, that they have to be solved fast?
Normally maximum about a week production.
Okay.
But it can be a week over 24 lines.
Okay. Sumit, yeah.
So that is about, say, 25 times about 250 SKUs. Probably a couple of hundred intermediate processes.
Okay, Sumit.
Hi, this is Sumit. I'm also one of Ignacio's students. I have a question about something you mentioned in the beginning of your talk. You said you want to investigate the trade-off between flexibility and what you can do on the operational level. And it sounded to me that the I mean, what you described here was mainly on the operational level. Can you give us some insight how you would go to, you know, consider the flexibility issue? In other words, you know, how to make design changes to connect maybe different processing lines to different packaging lines and these kinds of questions?
Yeah, okay. I think I have two different questions in your question. Let me first start with the one that I tried to address in the presentation, is that if you look to operators, they would like to have maximum flexibility. So they would like to be able to connect everything to everything. If you connect everything to everything, then very often your whole scheduling problem is getting even more complicated. So that's not what we would like to do. We would like to get maximum flexibility with minimum, let's say, physical connections.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that we can do and we have done in here is, for example, looking into those graphs like these graphs, and identifying, for example, are there any tanks or vessels that, for example, are used too much, or can we use less vessels? And for example, if any vessels is not being used, for example, in those aging tanks, there are a couple of vessels that have not been used at all. If you connect those vessels to one of the lines that are being in heavy demand, we might gain more, say, capacity in the factory.
Okay.
So we do, it's a combination from physical process engineering insight, supported by, let's say, these type of scheduling models to prove the ideas.
Okay. Yeah, actually, it reminded me a little bit of, hello?
Yeah?
Oh, we just lost the screen. Okay, no, never mind. It reminded me actually a little bit of problem in operations management theory, where you have certain factories and certain products you have to assign to, you know, different factories, and you have setup costs to make those links. And actually, they look into, you know, type of similar problems, you know, how to connect those things, those make those connections. And, just as a comment.
Yeah. No, I think that's absolutely true. And also in here, one of the things that we found was that getting that, let's say, mathematically completely correct very often goes to the expense of that you can only do very limited cases. Choices that you can make.
Yeah, Peter.
Well, we found that by using these type of graphical, heuristical knowledge that you have as an engineer, combined with these type of systems, you might investigate much broader pictures, much broader areas, and then zoom into the key questions very quickly.
By the way, if I can, since you have this picture of the Gantt chart, one thing I'm very curious, you showed some tables with values of changeover times, and what caught my attention is that in quite a few of them, they seem to be symmetric in the sense that, say, going from A to B was the same as going from B to A, at least in some, especially polymer type of applications, and I think also I would say especially polymer, those tend to be asymmetric. So can you give us maybe some insight as to why these changeovers tend to be symmetric?
Yes, at least for example, this is one of them. If you look to the packing line, 480 basically means a complete shift. This is where they have to, this is a kind of a rotating table where you have molded ice creams in there. In order to remove the molds, put the molds back, different molds in there, you need to glue them. And it takes about 7 hours or 6 hours for the glue to harden. So that is why in this specific case, it is symmetrical. Normally, it is not symmetrical. Also, if you look to the colors, it normally is not symmetrical. For example, you can, if you have one white ice cream, you can go to yellow ice cream without any changeover at all, very often. And then go to green, red, purple, and brown. But if you go from brown to white, then you need to clean it.
So why was it the case that here the for the colors the values are symmetric? Is that maybe just a test case or?
No, this is not as a test case. This is basically because this was this was for a factory who for the first time had to think about their changeover tables.
I see. Right. Okay.
So if I would have shown another one of a little mature factory, you would see that. For very often use four different changeover tables, so we characterize the mix into a lot of different characteristics like colors, allergens, additions, etc. And each of them has a certain changeover characteristic.
All right.
Okay. And basically the time is a kind of a physical relation that either it takes you no time to clean it, or you can just have a short water flush where you need to do a full clean.
Right. Okay, thank you very much. Let's see, and maybe just one very quick question. Pablo, do you want to come here? But very quick, please.
Hello, I'm Pablo. I'm postdoc here with Ignacio. My question is about the necessary conditions to enable successful implementation. You talked about looking for robustness rather than the optimal solution to the last digit. Does the informed scheduling system you're using, do it takes into account this robust test requirement in some way?
By experience, it does. One of the things is that, and I think it uses a kind of a time-based network, because the exact starting and end times are not, for example, they're discretized. So in that sense, it uses a certain shared form of robustness. And basically what we've seen is that if it doesn't know what to do, it just starts, for example, alphabetically. Or it starts in the way that you've listed it. So you can manipulate the robustness a bit.
So well, I'm curious, so you mentioned discretized. Do you know if they use discrete time, or, I mean, it sounds like the application...
I think they're using discrete time.
Yeah.
And the other thing is what they're using is they start from the list, from top to bottom first as kind of an allocation, and then as a more optimization.
I see. Okay. All right. Well, I think we're, running out of time now, and really want to thank you very much, Peter, for a very nice and interesting presentation. Really appreciate it very much. And we'll be posting the presentation, both with the slides and the audio, in the website. And also for those of you who might be, you know, still connected, just to remind you, October 13th, we have our EWO meeting here at Carnegie Mellon, and those of you are coming, well, we look forward to seeing you here then. All right? Thank you very much, and we'll keep in touch. And Peter, again, thank you very much, then. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Thanks so much.
Bye. So the mystery of Infor. We need to find out what they do.
Reverse engineering.
Yeah, exactly.